Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Arms and Armor of the Siege. This talk is delivered by Dr. Stephen Spiteri.
Very, very encouraging to have such a remarkable audience on such a cold winter day and on Carnival Monday. I wasn't expecting such a large turnout, and this is really a source of great satisfaction to me as president of the Malta Historical Society. These lectures are proving to be a resounding success, and it's all due to the credit of one of our most hard-working committee members, Mr. Salvatore Musu. They are the brainchild of Mr. Salvatore Musu, and really I think we should be all grateful. The Historical Society should be very grateful to him. Through his effort, he is injecting a new blood into our society. And that's one of the things that I've set out as a mission statement when I was elected president of the society, to inject the society with a new lease of life. But today, it's my great pleasure to reintroduce Dr. Stephen Spiteri. It is the second of his lectures on the Great Siege, and Dr. Spiteri is the expert on fortifications, on armor. The books that he has published on the subject do him great credit, and they are works of reference. And it's also a great satisfaction to me that I was, in spite of the fact that Dr. Spiteri was neither in my department at university nor as a faculty of art yet, I was his supervisor for his PhD thesis. And it's one of the most remarkable PhD theses that I've had the honor of supervising. Well, Dr. Spiteri has given a great contribution, and I am very sure that today's lecture will do him added credit. So we're all looking forward, Dr. Spiteri, to your lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Bohajar, for a very encouraging introduction. I'm glad that you are all here today. It truly gives people like us great pleasure to be able to diffuse the knowledge that we acquire through the years, and be able to obviously, this 1 hour that I have at my disposal, probably even less, does not do justice to a subject of this entity. The Great Siege is, as I said in my earlier lecture, is a subject which in many ways is still being discovered. Obviously, there's a huge volume of work which many distinguished scholars before me have contributed, and here I salute Dr. Albert Ganado, who has done a great service to this field of study. His cartography and his studies in the plans of the fortifications have prepared, even for myself, a beaten track to follow, made it much easier than having to start from scratch. But there are other aspects, and I will go into the one we are discussing today, that is the arms and armor, or better still, I do not like distill this subject to these terms. I think of warfare in terms of organization, of the ability of any armed force and any society to organize itself for warfare. And again, this is a subject which, as far as the Great Siege goes, has not really been studied. Most of the time, these military aspects of the siege have been taken as read, as given in Bozio, Balbi, and the other chroniclers of the period, but with very little analysis of what was really happening on the ground. And I like to look at this subject, and what I have tried in my small measure to do was at least to bring all the known facts together and see them through the eye in the way similar battles and similar conflicts have been studied by other historians. As I said in my first lecture, a great siege depends on many elements. One of the foremost is that it could not have been called a siege if there were no fortifications. Similarly, there could not have been any fighting if there were no armed forces. Basically, my lecture, which will revolve, although the title, as I said, is Arms and Armor, it will be also a study of the way these arms and armor and the military organization of both military forces, that is the knights and their Spanish allies, and the Ottoman armed forces were able to execute their strategies and tactics on the ground. Again, we have to see this also within the context. Warfare is also largely a product of the landscape and what the landscape allows an armed force to achieve. Again, there is very little time in this lecture to go into these. Hopefully, for those who were here in the previous lecture, one can tie in these elements which we'll be discussing today with the manner in which the fortifications and the landscape surrounding the Grand Harbor and Marsamshet was able to allow these processes to evolve in this panel. Again, most of what I will be saying, though not all, can be read in my publication. However, since 2005, there has been one important development in that I was able to access for the first time the notarial archives vis-à-vis the notaries who were active in the period before and during the Great Siege. And these many volumes, which were not available, here gives you an idea of the fact that why these volumes were not available was largely because of the poor state of preservation of the notarial archives in Valletta. Just to give you an idea of the type these documents were stored. Fortunately, since 2005, these notarial archives came into the able hands of Dr. Cora Vella and also Mrs. Joan Abela, who, as you can see, have injected a new sense of order, a new sense of organization, and have made many of these archives, and I will be showing you examples of the type of information that can be found. It is not information that will change our knowledge of what happened during the siege, but it will show us the way the experiences of many of the people and soldiers who went through these 4 months of fighting. And one can glean and cull a lot of information in that sense in the way these individuals were armed, and their experience of certain events. So that is a very important element, and it will, as you see, the type of information that I have been able to trace, there is much more work that still needs to be done, can help us understand this event even better. Now, as I said, the Great Siege was the result of two armed forces, two armies. It is very difficult to use this term army for the type of troop forces and the organization of forces. It's not a modern army in the sense, especially the Knights of the Order of St. John, vis-à-vis their opponents, the Ottoman Armada, the Ottoman troops. This order of battle here gives us an idea of the proportion, what we call the order of battle, of the way the two sides confronted each other. Again, one of the first questions which immediately comes to the fore once you start studying the siege, and one which has tremendous importance vis-à-vis the gravity of the situation and the way, as far as the knights were concerned, is the size of the Ottoman army. Now, again, there are owing to the nature of the type of information which has come down to us, which is largely that as recorded by Christian and Western chroniclers, one finds that the traditional, most, in fact, of the accounts tend to exaggerate the, and extremely exaggerate the size of the Ottoman army. Now, this obviously was done for propagandistic purposes. In fact, at one point in time, it even became a tool which worked against the Knights of the Order of St. John. It was a double, because once the Ottoman Armada arrived on the island, the Order of St. John, in its attempt, in its desperate attempt to rally Christian support, began to exaggerate these figures. Now, actual fact, one of the reasons why then Don Garcia de Toledo took an extraordinary long time to mobilize his forces and send them over, actually, not mobilize them, send them over to Malta, was his fear of this huge, gigantic Turkish force which was reputed to be on the island. He could not afford, one has to remember, that the Great Siege is only an episode in a wider, larger conflict. Again, this is also a manner when one studies the siege to keep these important factors in mind. It is an episode, as I said, in what many have described as the, and what does it sound better, Il Guerra di Nia, or the World War of the 16th century, which is this struggle between the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburg Spaniards most of the time. Once the island becomes Hospitaller possession, the Hospitaller Knights are placed immediately on this frontier between these two opposing forces. And the Great Siege, as I had said in the other lectures, was not the first experience of the Order of St. John to be in the situation where they were subjected to strong retaliatory and punishing attacks by the Ottoman Empire. It was actually, in many ways, can be seen as the part two of the Siege of Rhodes. So this situation, whereby the knights seek to exploit this element of their position, as I said, was actually, initially during the siege, it actually turns against them. In fact, there's a very interesting letter by Vincenzo Anastaghi to Ascanio della Cornia, who was the commander-in-chief of the Gran Soccorso, where Vincenzo, in very simple terms, he tells him, please do not continue hesitating to come to Malta, because all the Turks have brought with them here are not more than 22,000 troops. And this cuts down to a very realistic figure, the 40,000 and 80,000 figures which had been bandied around at the time of the siege. Again, this figure of the Ottoman army, the 20,000 mark, is actually very, very realistic, and one compares it to the way the Ottoman armies were fighting in Hungary, and one sees that the Turks rarely ever brought together a force more than 14,000 men. So the 22,000 figure is very, very credible, and I think that, in my opinion, it is the one which really shows the size of the Turkish fleet. Now, what this actually does is that it reduces the numerical advantage which the Ottoman army had on the Christian force. The knights could bring together around 6,000 to 7,000 men, including the militia. So the ratio, the superiority ratio of the Ottoman army was not more than roughly 3 or 4 to 1. Which is not really that much. Even today, most military commanders believe that they would require a ratio of 10 to 1 to ensure outright success in their favor. So what this figure also shows us, that the Turkish or Ottoman army did not really have that command and advantage over the landscape. And this comes out in various instances. For example, the arrival of the Piccolo Soccorso is really a very clear, indicative episode, which shows the great loopholes in the layout of the Turkish Armada and its control over the landscape. Anyway, this is just to give you an idea. I will start first by describing the organization of the Hospitaller armed forces. Again, I tend to refrain from referring to it as an army. The concept of a modern army is something which does not apply to these type of forces. To begin with, this is warfare which is still largely the product of the feudal system. The Knights of the Order of St. John had by this time they are trying to fight a modern war, but relying on devices and mechanisms which still harps to the earlier medieval period. And what we do find is actually a core of about 500 professional knights. Many of them, one must remember, were actually quite old people. They weren't really in fighting. They weren't capable of fighting. And however, these knights did not fight as they fought as individuals. If you look at the way the Hospitaller system was designed, these knights trained in individual marksmanship and prowesses. They did not fight and train to maneuver huge volumes of men in the manner which the modern armies would seek to do in today. So the core, this little small core of around 500 knights, which when one studies the various sieges in the Order of St. John, appears to be the maximum amount of knights which the order could bring together for any major siege. These knights were supplemented by either a large mercenary force. In fact, one can see this mercenary nature of the Hospitaller armed forces. It goes back all the way to the Holy Land with the Turkopoles and other foreign soldiers, and also a larger component were the native militia, those people who, again, in feudal manner, were obliged to render service to the Order of St. John. Now, as we see here, this is a breakdown. For more detail, you can look up the book. All these elements are explained in much more detail and supported by the necessary documentation. So what we do have in 1565 is a corps of professional knights, around 500 to 600 men, a contingent of Spanish and Italian troops. Now, it is important to remember that the Spanish tercios, that is the Spanish regiments, were not fighting under the control of the knights. They were sent to Malta to assist the knights, in fact, one of the biggest problems Grandmaster Lavalette encounters in the defense of St. Elmo is the fact that these Spanish troops had no intention of being sacrificed simply to gain time. And the Grandmaster then was placed in a difficult situation. And there is also, as I will be showing you some examples, the Knights of St. John recruited a number of mercenaries. Again, many of the professional soldiers in the order's employees were actually professional mercenaries. People who were recruited in Italy, most of them in Italy and Sicily, and that's why we call them as soldati, and fought for money. The other large element were the Maltese militia from the villages and even from the two towns of Birgu and the city of Andina. These made the bulk. Here is a breakdown of the various regiments, totaling to around 5,000 men from the villages of Birgirka army. Again, you can read about all these elements. An important factor, which again I have to stress, is the nature of the fighting. The Great Siege occurs at a time in the 16th century when there was this revolution in warfare which was being enacted, and largely this was the result both of the importance of a new weapon now. The firearm enabled huge armies to be brought together and trained in a relatively short period of time, unlike the other form of weapons, the crossbows, and which required training over long periods of time. These modern armies, which were beginning to appear, allowed for large contingents of men to be armed with a very effective weapon. However, again, we see that this weapon, the way it is being employed, is still not very well understood and put to use efficiently. In fact, most of the siege was acted out largely as a large skirmish, where what you had happening was the initial discharge of firearms and then a large, massive infantry assault designed to overcome the defenses by sheer weight of numbers. And as we shall see, not the Turkish army was not equipped, in fact, to undertake such warfare. Right, beginning with the Knights of St. John, the Hospitaller Army, the core of this fighting force were the knights, right? This medieval warrior who came to the fore as an armored fighting man. Also, the Knight of St. John, the knight was initially most effective as a mounted warrior. His use as a heavily armored infantry obviously was less effective, and in fact, this is what we actually find happening at the Great Siege. The Knights of St. John were fighting largely as heavily armored infantry. They were fighting on foot behind the safety of the fortification. The small cavalry force, as I will be showing you, was largely made up of Maltese noblemen, those people who could afford to and were obliged to keep a horse, and so it was not really a Hospitaller cavalry. Anyway, the local terrain did not allow for the cavalry forces to operate and fight as a mass to use the shock effect of its charge. So what we had there was actually a mounted infantry being used mainly for reconnaissance. So what was the equipment of a Hospitaller knight in the mid-16th century? It was still largely steel cuirass, which could be found in the earlier centuries. However, it had undergone various changes. What we immediately realize is that it provides protection for only the upper part of the body, the legs and lower half of the torso was unprotected, and this was because the knight now had to rely no longer on, because of firearms and the destructive effect of firearms, he could not remain and afford to be a static, easy target weapon. So he had to be mobile, and this meant he had to shed some of his armor. So what we have is usually what is known as a corslet or half armor, consisting of a steel helmet, either a morion or a bourgonnet, a breastplate with arm defenses, a pauldron and cooters, and the lower defenses for the torso, which were known as the tassets. Most of the armor in the knightly class, however, at this period in time, was very finely decorated, as I'll be showing examples. The other weapons, which we'll be seeing also, were the pole arms and swords. The sword was still now the weapon, preferred weapon of the knight for close combat fighting, which was usually what happened in the siege. And the crossbow, which also remained an important weapon, despite the introduction of very efficient firearms. By the 1500s, the arquebus and the petronel, as we've seen, although still largely inaccurate in long range, however, it had become nonetheless a very easy weapon to use and had supplanted most of these early projectile weapons. Again, the armor from around this period is very finely decorated. It's a style of decoration which is usually referred to as grotesque, again, because it is of the nature of its decoration. It makes use of various foliage and grotesque type of hybrid animals and creatures, classical. So it is the type of decoration which is found on the armor of the period. Again, one does find, in fact, these examples here are taken from the palace armory. However, it is very difficult to establish with any degree of certainty that these particular armors, which can be found in the army, actually date to their conflict. We have various instances after the siege where many new armors were purchased, and Grandmaster de Valette himself, in one of his letters, speaks of the, what he says, the grand consumation delle armi, and obviously after 4 months of fighting, most of the armor. Again, the other problem with the study of the armory is that the Knights of St. John were obliged by regulation to provide for their own armor. These weapons only found their way into the palace armory, or the Armeria Publica, as it was known, only after the death of these knights. By statute, these weapons, particularly those knights who were living in the convent, were obliged to leave their armor for the army. However, again, we have very little evidence to actually date these elements to the Great Siege itself. This is the type of decoration, the foliage, the strap work, and there are various devices which are used. These are some details of the elements which are found on grotesque type of decoration of armor from the period. Perhaps the only one which can be surely dated to the Great Siege is Jean de Valette's cuirass. Again, you can see here with three bands of grotesque decoration. It also shows gilding, traces of gilding, and in fact, painting of the fresco of Dalecho actually shows Grand Master Jean de Valette in gilded armor. Again, it is there's a matching backplate, and what is known as a falling buff, which complements the armor. Another feature of the this armor from this period is the splinted base of the breastplate, which was designed to give a bit of mobility. In fact, later armors from around the 1570s and 1580s acquired a pronounced piece cod, what is known as piece cod form. So one way of dating this armor to the mid-16th century is usually by this presence of this splint here. Another element which most knights employed in their attire, in their armor, was the use of the sopra vest. The knights were bound by regulation to wear a red surcoat with white cross, which was the battle standard of the order. And again, one finds two types of surcoats being employed. The Grand Master had a larger type, similar to what is known as a tabard, with a large cross and very long sleeves. The knights themselves, in fact, we can have a very good idea here from the bronze effigy on the tombstone of Grand Master La Valette in the crypt of St. John's Concadigil, where you see the tabard also decorated by this floral band around the neck and arms. The rest of the troops, however, are always shown wearing a very tight-fitting surcoat. Again, there is some indication that these were not surcoats at all, but actually painted breastplates. In fact, I managed to come across an inventory of the Medina Armory in 1556, and it actually shows, as I will be showing you, refers to various shields which were painted with the cross of the order. So this practice of actually painting these rather than wearing surcoat, a linen surcoat, is also a possibility. For head protection, the knights wore a variety of helmets. Again, basically there were two main types, the morion and the cabazet, and the bourgonnette. Again, these are examples from the palace army with the type of decoration which is found throughout most of the 16th century, not necessarily in 1565. And again, they show this very rich armor which was worn by the knightly class. Most of the other troops, like the Spanish mercenaries, the tercios, and many of the other recruited troops, would have worn what is known as munitions armor. It's plain, similarly very effective steel armor, but usually undecorated. This is another armor typical of the period. It is attributed to having been the armor of Grandmaster Garces, but it is it's a German armor from the 1560s. Again, there is nothing to actually tie it either to the Grandmaster or to the Great Siege period. This in the portrait is Vincenzo Anastasi, or Anastasi as he's also known. Again, he's shown wearing the breastplate, the corslet with pauldrons. It's not decorated armor as far as I can see. The tessets have been used. And here you can see the bourgonnette. Vincenzo Anastasi was he fought most of the siege. He was stationed in Medina and had the privileged position to reconnoiter all the Turkish positions and and his accounts to Ascanio della Cornea is actually one of the most detailed, in my opinion, most realistic when it comes to surveying and understanding what was going on. The sword, despite the fact that firearms were fastly and rapidly becoming an important weapon, even for the knights, in fact, if you see the descriptions of the armor, of the weapons which the knights were expected to arm themselves with, the musket is a requisite. However, the sword was still the fighting weapon of the knight. Again, we have very practically hardly any examples from the period. The only sword which fits the picture is that attributed to have belonged to Grandmaster Jean de Valette and now found in the Burgo Parish Museum. This is the type of rapier. It's a transitional rapier still. Sometimes these are referred to as stock type of swords, a cruciform type of swords. There is the ring guard here for the, which becomes a very important feature of later rapiers. So this would have been the personal sword of most of the knights fighting in the close quarter combat of all the episodes in the siege. Another very important weapon, in fact it is also illustrated in Dalleccio's prints and frescoes, is the hand and a half or double-handed sword, what the Spanish call the smontante, which was actually a specialized, the soldiers who specialized in this use of this sword were paid extra than the other troops. It's a cutting sword and was very effective in cleaving through the armor, especially the armor worn by the Turkish swords. These swords would have been kept in reserve by just in the immediate vicinity of the soldiers, either using their pikes or muskets to repel the initial Turkish charge. And then when the Turks would overwhelm the position, the soldiers would resort to these weapons, which were very effective in close combat. Like I mentioned earlier, although the knight per se was a mounted warrior, the Hospitaller knights fighting during the Great Siege hardly made use of this important arm. There were various reasons for this. In fact, the records show that the Hospitallers kept a very small mounted cavalry force, around 30 knights in all. The rest were all Maltese, either nobles in Medina or militiamen who could afford or obliged to keep a horse. Again, the records speak of these soldiers being the 33 Hospitaller knights being very heavily armed, and the rest of the soldiers being mounted alla leggera, that is, in very, very lightly. And one can understand why this was, because the cavalry, when Grandmaster Jean de Valette stations the cavalry in Medina, his idea was for the cavalry to act as a fighting reconnaissance and interfere with the rear guard of the Turkish army. And we get various instances in Galeccio's prints and frescoes showing the nature of these combined cavalry and infantry patrols, which each day used to go out of Medina and seek to reconnoiter the Turkish movements and also attack the foraging parties. So the nature of the local terrain did not allow for concentrated cavalry charges in large numbers. So these mounted cavalry forces actually fought as mounted infantry. They would seek to lay ambuscades and ambushes and try to trap foraging parties as they set out from the Turkish camp in Marsa looking for supplies and victuals. Again, other instances from the depiction of the Turkish cavalry force harassing these foraging parties. As I said, only about 30 of these troops were heavily armored knights. The rest are mounted alla leggera. And reconstructed drawings showing the nature of what these troops would have looked like. It's in one of the documents at the National Archives which I was able to come across very recently. There's a very interesting description of the items which were found in the possession of one of the Maltese living in Medina. This testament is dated 26th October 1565. It is about a month after the termination of hostilities. And what is interesting is that it describes the equipment of a mounted Maltese trooper. Yeah, and basically, when you see here, it's a scopetta, this is an arquebus, a lancina, which is short stabbing lance, due lapardi, which are two halberds, again, a type of axe combined with a spear, un quarzaletto, that is a breastplate, un giacco di maglia, that is a chainmail vest, usually worn underneath the quarzaletto, un paio di maniche, these arm defenses, again, of chainmail, and due balestri, that is two crossbows of firing stone shot. In fact, I found a number of inventories from people living in Indy now, judging by the type of armor, probably well-to-do persons who could afford, therefore, to fight as mounted. This is, again, detail from the inventory, an inventory by notary Antonio Costar from 1556. It's a very detailed, this is only one page, inventory of the arms and armor, which in 1556 could be found in the Medina Armory. And among the interesting items it shows, as I mentioned earlier, was the rotelli, that is the shields, con le armi della religione, with the cross painted on the shields itself. So this practice of painting the armor, although initially a suspicion of many historians, is actually now very well documented. An important element of the Hospitaller Force, as I mentioned, was the mercenary element. And again, we find in the months prior to the siege, various knights. I managed to trace seven of these. Eight knights are given a commission by the Council of the Order to go to Sicily and recruit foreign mercenaries. Again, there's a list of the type of troops, largely from Naples, Sicily, Calabria, Rome, and Florence, around 1,000 something men, who actually did not make it to Malta before the arrival of one of the criticism which is leveled against Jean de Valette and his council was the fact that they took a long time to set this mobilization, the Hospitaller mobilization, into force. And by the time that these troops had gathered in Messina and other ports of Italy, it was already too late, and they could not be. In fact, many of them only come to Malta with the Gran Soccorso. They did not reach the island. Again, an important element, these are the type of troops, the Spanish troops, the mercenaries, the tercios, obviously, the Spanish regiments would have come all equipped with the issue weapons given by the Spanish authorities. The tercio is an interesting order of battle in the fact that the Spanish army, now that it was one of the first armies in Europe, which was recruiting professional full-time standing armies. And many of these troops obviously were being paid by the wealth which was arriving from South America, so the Spanish were able to arm a very large contingent of troops. The tercios in Sicily, some of regiments and companies from these regiments were dispatched to Malta in the months prior to the siege, and these troops, in fact, were the most professional troops the order had at its disposal. Many of these were sent to garrison St. Elmo once it became clear that the Turks had set the siege of this fort as their main priority. And in fact, the Grand Master bargains most of his troops there, and many of the professional troops were actually consumed in the defense of this fort. And by the time the siege moves over to Birgu and Senglia, the Grand Master and obviously the knights had to rely then largely on the Maltese militia to do most of the fighting. And however, the two type of firearms which are found in this period are the arquebus, which was the lighter type of firearm, could be fired without the use of any rest, and the larger musket. Again, we have no examples, even in terms of the history of firearms. It's very difficult to find examples of firearms and arquebuses dating from this period. This is an arquebus, which was actually a hunting piece from the Grand Master's collection, which found its way into the palace armory. You can notice that it's not a military firearm, it's by its elaborate decoration and inlay. It's a matchlock, the firing mechanism which is in use. In this period are two, actually. There's the matchlock and the less reliable wheel lock mechanism. In fact, there's an interesting report by Lapparelli after the siege when he's recommending the type of armament which should be used to equip a new garrison. And he says that the arquebusia rota, that is the spring wheel lock mechanism, should be used for night fighting because they do not give away the position of the soldiers. The problem with these matchlocks was that the soldiers had to keep this match here, which was the ignition of the powder. They had to keep this alight. Obviously, it gave away the smoldering tip, would give away the position of any surprise night attack. In fact, here I have an interesting short documentary which explains the limitations of these type of firearms.
This is a 1643 pattern match.
A later version, but
the way it's fired is you put gunpowder into the pan, gunpowder down the other end, and to make him go bang, a piece of burning match cord is fastened in, and you simply pull the trigger, and the burning match cord ignites the gunpowder. Very, very slow firing, the good musketeer. One, maybe two shots per minute. When a musket ball from this hits you, it punches a hole in. It doesn't cut it like a modern bullet. So the wounds can be absolutely staggering. Pushing bone out the back. I'm going to fire this. Now I'm using a cartridge, just a paper cartridge of gunpowder. You bite the end off. I'm going to fill the pan full of gunpowder. There we go, just enough. Close that. Blow off or shake off any loose powder, but watch that burning match, because you could set off the charge. It often happened in the Civil War. You then bring your musket so that you can see down the muzzle, down the barrel, shake down the gunpowder. You then put a musket ball down. You then put the broken paper in there, which acts as a wipe. Take out your scouring stick, reverse it, shorten it to a handful. You then scour home your charge, because the soldiers were so nervous of this. It's the beginning of drill movement. Remove thy scouring stick. Reverse it. Replace it. Because if you didn't replace your scouring stick and you fired, you'd shoot that wooden stick at the enemy and wouldn't be able to reload. They then must blow upon their match cord. Make sure you've got a burning tip there. Once again, you've got to fit it into those jaws. And right in the heat of battle, you've got to ensure that that will actually touch the gunpowder. We're now ready to fire. And what you simply do is open that pan, present, and give fire.
Right. So one of the things which is interesting in what the reenactor stated is that the slow rate of fire. Now what this actually meant was that the soldiers had to be protected while they tried to reload their weapons. And an interesting element which comes throughout the description of the soldiers, especially as they were fighting in St. Elmo, is the fact that each musketeer had to be protected by two pikemen. So the pikemen would try to keep the Turks at bay. The pike was not a very good defensive weapon inside a fortress. It was a very long shaft weapon, so it could not be easily manhandled within the restricted confines of the fortress. And hopefully this will allow the gunners to reload their weapons and be able to discharge it against the enemy. Again, the depictions by Dalecho, which is the main graphic visuals we have of the siege, shows very distinctively this downward breach of the muskets, which shows them to be petronels. As you see, the petronel has a very distinct curved butt, and most of the illustrations of the troops fighting in the Dalia Chog paintings and frescoes and prints do show this type of weapon. And this, as I said, most of the troops had to fight protected by pikemen. Again, however, this type of situation could not be sustained for long. It usually happened that the Turks would overwhelm the positions, and then most of the fighting would have had to be done by swords. The militia, again, at this point in time, were very poorly armed. There's a lot of evidence to show that they were still practically issued with the pre-hospitaller equipment, largely a cotton jubbe, which was like al-oton. It is a vest made from quilted cotton. It was a typical armament of most common troops. Bozio's description of this type of armament mentions that it was trapuntata, that is, it was fitted with metal studs to give it some more protection. Again, the Maltese also wore a padded hat, a berettone. And there's an interesting detail in one of Favre's paintings showing Grandmaster Lilla Dam taking possession of Imbina, shows berettone of the Maltese militia. So again, this is a detail which could also be a product of Favre's imagination, but probably taken also from Bozio's description of the Maltese themselves. Again, some of the troops seem to have been fitted with firearms, but largely the weapons which were at the disposal of the Maltese militia were the lanzina, which is a short spear, a shield, and crossbows and bows. Again, the shaft weapons, again, would have been used to arm most of the common troops. These were very simple but effective fighting weapons, especially when used en masse, for a whole body of troops defending a position. And we have all sorts of types here, from halberds to spontoons and bills, or tang de bœuf, as they were called. Another weapon which still found use, although largely rendered obsolete by the firearm, was the crossbow. And there, the Great Siege also makes a specific reference to the issue of such weapons during a rainy spell towards the end of the siege. A problem with the arquebus, as you've seen, which depended on a smoldering match cord, was that it could not be fired in wet conditions. And in fact, we find the knights distributing many crossbows, steel crossbows, to the troops, and they were able to stem and plug the tide of one of the attacks. What is also interesting is that this was not the last instances where the knights are stocking up on crossbows. There is one other instance in Bozio relating to 1567, when the knights received again another large consignment of around 100, it says 100 casse, 100 casse, that is a huge assignment of crossbows similar to these. As probably many of these were these weapons which are still available. Again, we see also the distribution of some crossbows in the documents of the Università in those months prior to the siege itself. There's mention of weapons and muskets being distributed to the people of Imbina. Time is passing, so I have to rush through the Turkish army. The Turkish troops largely came in two basic categories. There were what are known as capicolo troops, that is the standing regiments, largely known today as the janissaries. These were the professional troops of the... And then there were the feudal type of levies, were known as the sipahis, which were equivalent to a certain degree to the European knight. The janissaries were lightly armed. They were mainly infantry troops, equipped with projectile weapons and swords. One of the main interesting features of this is that the janissary generally chose his own weapon. Again, this concept, although these janissaries fought in regiments, however, they did not fight as automata. They were individual warriors, who fought in an individual style. And this characteristic feature of the Janissaries was once that continued to plague the Turkish military organization well into the 19th century. In fact, the Janissaries had to actually be eradicated from the Turkish system, military system, because they were very fierce, independent warriors who fought on their own terms and sought to reject the European way of being regimentized into fighting set pieces. The Turkish musket of the period is known as the Tufenk. We have one example here, still fitted with a matchlock mechanism, dating from around that period. Again, usually the Turkish Tufenk was slightly longer than the arquebus, and it had a longer range, and was a much more effective sniping weapon than the Christian firearm. And various descriptions by Bozzi of the Janissaries, their distinctive felt hat, usually with a plume holder. Again, these are Janissary Marines here on parade, showing the various devices which are used. The larger component parts of the Ottoman army were the Sipahis. These were the armored warriors. They were cavalry warriors. Their armor and equipment was designed for mounted warfare, again, and not siege warfare. In fact, the biggest problem of the Ottoman army on siege, it was always at a disadvantage because these troops were not designed to attack fortified position against heavily armored and defended enemy. So their equipment was not designed to absorb punishment. It was designed for mobile, very swift form of attack, usually using their bow and arrows to pepper the enemy forces with shower of arrows, and then retreat to a safer distance and continuing this attack. When placed in siege trenches and made to attack across deadly fields of fire, and then made to attack positions which were heavily defended by armored troops, they were at a very big disadvantage. And the equipment of Turkish Sipahis consisted of a chainmail vest, very light bronze plate armor for the torso, a zisaj or helmet for, again, with chainmail. Then there are a variety of sabers. The Turkish sword was a saber type of sword designed for slashing rather than penetrating the enemy, like the Hospitaller swords. Wooden shields or wooden or bronze shields. A distinctive form of the Turkish shield is this pointed element here. Again, these were Hungarian type of shields which found their way into the Ottoman army. This is Zizaj. We have two examples at the Palace Armory. Again, it is very difficult to date these items because the style of Turkish armament remains valid well into the 17th century, so there's no way of knowing if these elements were actually present at the time of siege. Again, you can see that although this very armored warrior, however, Dalecho's representation of the Turkish forces never shows Turkish armor. It shows them usually robed figures. And the reason for this was that most of these troops actually wore robes over their armor. So this could be one reason why. Again, as I said, the Sipahis were mounted warriors. They were not designed to fight on foot. And in fact, it appears they did not bring any horses with them to the island. There's only a few mentioned in the accounts of mounted Sipahis, usually the higher senior officers. Again, these are reconstructions. These are the Dalecho's representations showing, as you see, the lack of armor, the robes probably worn over this type of armor. These are typical Sipahis, various types of swords. Again, one can read all about these. And this is a surviving shield from the period. It's not found in Malta. It's in the Tyrol Museum. There's a collection of weapons there, which, again, you can see, again, Dalecho's depiction of these pointed shields. So he was... A large, important weapon in terms of quantity was the Turkish bow. Most of these Sipahis were not armed with firearms. They were armed with a small composite Turkish bow, which was, again, not very effective against penetrating armor over large distances. In fact, when one reads through the chronicles, one reads a lot about the type of wounds that many of the knights had, was usually weapons penetrating their exposed elements, their hands, their faces, and not the armor itself. There's an interesting, again, I managed to download this from the YouTube. This is a composite Turkish bow, so small, but nonetheless very powerful at close range weapon, which was used by the Turkish Sipahis. And there's a reconstruction showing the Turks at disadvantage trying to assault the fortified positions, which were very well designed to provide deadly crossfire from cannon firing, and they were placed, therefore they had to use a lot of siege works, that is trenches and other opera soldates, that is improvised defenses, usually consisting of rubble stones and masses over, to try to find their way as close as possible to the defenses. A large component of the Turkish army, Ottoman army, sorry, were the presence of volunteers, Levans, and other irregulars. These were all equipped on an individual basis. They were not very well armed, very lightly armed, and they were used largely as cannon fodder and let loose before the charges of the more precious Sipahis and Janissaries. The Ottoman army relied on its numeric superiority to try to force issues by means of weight of number. Again, another, though to a lesser extent, component of the Ottoman force were the North African Barbary corsairs. Again, these were very lightly armed. Although Bozio and Balbi mentioned tens of thousands of these troops, Vincenzo Anastasi says that there were only about 1,500 of them. So, again, they lost heart after their first engagement at Senglia, when they were retreated after being repulsed and are not really encountered many more times during that. Yes, this is interesting. This is one of the documents I came across in the notarial archives. For some reason, the caption has disappeared. What it actually shows is the inventory in a testament after the death of Certain Bernardo Magri, again residing in Mdina, who reveals in his presence, this is after the siege, not a long time after the siege, who reveals in his presence a number of Turkish items, including Turkish caps, Turkish muskets. So there seems to have been some sort of collector club just after the siege. With all those thousands of dead Turks, I mean, there must have been a surplus of equipment doing the rounds. In fact, what is rather strange, when one compares, for example, the great siege of Malta with the Turkish siege of 1522 in Rose, is this lack of material evidence and even archaeological evidence to a certain degree. If those who are familiar with Rhodes would immediately recognize the huge amount, I mean, of cannonballs of large caliber, cannonballs strewn over the whole city. They keep coming up every time they dig up a trench, for example, and the Malta, all these elements, obviously Rhodes can be explained because Rose became backwater after 1522 and Malta continued to be. But again, this dirt of remains is also echoed in the equipment from the Turkish army. There's very little that has survived from the period. I'm sure that a large part of it, in fact, Bozio even hints at it. He says many of these were sold. They were very high demand by those troops who come after the siege, and they were large number of thousands of foreign troops stationed in Valletta as it was being built. So this could have been dissipated in this manner. But again, one would expect to find slightly more physical evidence of the siege. 7 o'clock, I would have liked to have gone into the siege the artillery boat, the fortress artillery and siege artillery. This was a very important component, part of both armies. The Turkish armada came very well equipped. and it belies those arguments, in my opinion, which try to make a case for the Great Siege having been simply a retaliatory attack on the Maltese garrison. The Turks would not have come equipped with a huge siege train. There were about 64 guns at the time it was being employed in its full force around the cities of Birgu and Senglia. For me, this huge investment in siege artillery showed that the Turkish armada came here very well prepared to subdue and take over the fortification, not simply to as a retaliatory attack against the Turkish. Again, various evidence for the type of guns. What we do not have is an official inventory of the equipment which was available at night. It was not a large number. One has to remember that artillery at this period is still a very difficult resource to come by. Guns were very, very expensive and very difficult to procure, not only produce, a variety of devices. In fact, after the siege, the knights only sent 14 large bronze pieces to Sicily to be refounded and only asked for 19 new cannons. And this works out at roughly 8 guns per fort, huge guns, because then there was a large variety of smaller weapons like the ones I've shown. There's this picture, the nature of the Turkish siege batteries. They came pre-equipped with prefabricated, what are known as gabions, to provide protection for the siege guns. Very, a lot of use is made of incendiary devices, for those who are interested. And to conclude, this is again another extract showing the wealth of type of information which can be found in the notarial archives. This is actually a note in the registers of notary Giacomo Baldacchino, dated 7th September, and it's praising God for the appearance of the Grand Socorso. In fact, he interrupts his record of work to lay the statement, thanking God that finally help has arrived. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Spiteri, for this fascinating lecture. Your research is opening a new window on our understanding of the Great Siege. I remember when the idea of a series of lectures of the Great Siege was first mooted at the committee of the Malta Historical Society, objections were raised. Why the Great Siege? So much has been written about it. Is there anything new that we can say about the Great Siege? Of course there is. There's a very, very great deal. There are a number of new insights on the Great Siege that one can explore and elaborate upon. And Dr. Spiteri's research shows us what new material, what new knowledge, what new insights can be gained into further studying in detail the Great Siege. And then there's, of course, the sociological aspect of the Great Siege. How did the Great Siege affect the ordinary men and women? How did they react to it? Thanks to Mr. Jonah Bela, who's here with us this evening, the work that she and her team are doing at the notarial archives, and the notarial archives are such a mine of information on coming to terms with the way that the Great Siege affected men and women, in ordinary men and women in Malta. I remember some 20 years ago, the late Father McAuliffe at Lua starting to write a social history of the Great Siege, and he had gathered quite a lot of important documents while working at the notarial archives when conditions there were very, very different from the conditions that there are today. Unfortunately, he died, and I've been trying to trace his notes. He did discuss them with me a great deal, had done a lot of work, but they apparently have disappeared. What happened to them, I do not know. And it's a great pity that they haven't yet been
relocated. I'm sure that they exist somewhere in some drawer at home or in some cupboard. But still, there's a great deal that can be done, and I hope that this is one of the great desiderata for the future, a social history of a great city. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Spiteri.
It was a great city, very stimulating episode in our history. And we're getting to grips with the great siege much better. Dr. Albert Ganado's book on the siege maps of Malta, which has opened such great possibilities, of a book that I use a great deal myself and can always use it with very, very great profit. So let's continue researching on the great siege. It's an important episode in our history. Thank you very much indeed.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled The Arms and Armor of the Siege. This talk was delivered by Dr. Stephen Spiteri.